afternoon. Nikolai Bailhart's with you for another week of the Country Hour. Plenty coming up this lunchtime. Orchardists are rallying against proposed labour hire laws that are before Parliament at the moment. Now, the state Labour government wants to increase the regulation of the labour hire industry. It's looking at things like licensing labour hire companies. But the people who need pickers and workers aren't particularly happy about that. We'll find out why. Also today, on another matter entirely, do Merino sheep hold the answer to the age-old question, why is curly hair curly and can you make it straight? Well, it turns out the humble sheep may help answer that question.
The technique we were using, we need to be able to see right away through the fibre. And fibres that were much thicker than that, we wouldn't have been able to investigate.
Agriculture and beauty treatments, they finally meet.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
The other thing that has been happening over the weekend, of course, I probably don't need to tell you, is that, hey, guess what? It actually rained a little bit. Now, it didn't rain everywhere. It only rained in some parts. But I would be keen to know how much you got. Was it enough? 0467 842 722 is the text number. If you'd like to let us know this lunchtime whether you were lucky enough to get a little bit of rain over the weekend. 0467 842 722. How much did you get? Is it enough? How important is it right now? Let's start the program this lunchtime with Daring, though. And dairy processor Bega says it has extended its current milk prices until the end of September. The unusual move, new milk prices for the opening season are usually announced in June, is partially designed to help Bega retain suppliers. Executive Chair of Bega, Barry Irvin, says that his company is also interested in buying the Koroit factory in southwest Victoria that Saputo may have to sell.
Yes, we've announced, Nikolai, that we will extend our current pricing for a further 3 months or for the opening 3 months of next financial year. So, in other words, our suppliers will receive exactly the same pay rate as they did for the same period last year. And obviously, we've done that given that, you know, there's a fair bit of gloom and doom around about, you know, what next year's outlook might be and what world prices are currently looking like, and we thought we needed to give our farmers some level of stability, and we thought a way of doing that would be for us to take the risk on the next 6 months period, if you like, in terms of our already announced price for this year and an extension into the next 3 months of next year.
And so am I right in saying that works out to an average of $5.63 a kilo?
$5.62
a kilo.
That's our weighted average, yeah.
How unusual is it to make this move?
Well, I'm not aware that it's ever been done before, so I suppose from that point of view it's unusual. But I think from our point of view, look, it's been a pretty tough time, as everybody knows, for the Australian dairy industry over recent years. And I think sometimes you've got to think differently to try and, you know, give some support and assistance to our suppliers. And so we thought that this was a way of saying, well, you can at least budget for the next 6 months. And I should say, Nikolai, that what we're saying is that in the event that the market improves, which would be wonderful, that's a minimum price. So at least they know what they'll get at a minimum for the next 6 months. And obviously, if the market improves, well, we'll look to improve that price. But as we all know at the moment, there's been some downward pressure and then just some stability in the more recent months.
Well, as you mentioned, a lot of people seem to be speculating, and it is just speculation, but saying that prices they thought, broadly speaking, would be lower than they are currently. So is it placing you under a significant financial risk to make this move?
Oh, look, it is certainly us taking the risk on it, and it would be several millions of dollars depending on where the market ends up. But we think that it's important to make sure that we also recognise the challenge that our suppliers have faced, you know, particularly last year, but even this year, they're still reporting to us that, you know, it's very difficult to make ends meet. So we were prepared to take that risk.
So what happens to prices after the end of September?
So obviously what we're doing here, Nikolai, is trying to give ourselves enough time to try and deliver as much stability as possible. So we will look to announce pricing you know, when we're confident about how the remainder of the year looks, if you like, and we will then, I guess, to be clear, we will make sure that our price for the remaining 9 months is competitive with the marketplace and reflective of the marketplace. So we won't be looking to recover any difference, if you like, in the remaining 9 months once we've announced them.
There is a risk it'd go down, though, isn't it?
There is a risk that it's going down, and there is definitely a risk that it's going down. And as I say, that's a risk that the company will bear.
Now, you've also announced a one-off 50 cents a kilo milk solids payment if people sign up to you for 3 years, 25 cents a kilo if people sign up to you for 2 years. Is that move basically designed to stop people going to Murray Goulburn / Saputo if Saputo go ahead?
No, not really. No, look, I think the reality of that is, and that's obviously for our Victorian supply base, and that is really about saying, can we drive some more cash flow into our farmers at a time when they clearly need it? So it does give them the opportunity to sign up for a 2 or 3 year period, but you know, many of our farmers have been with us for many years. We think that it's a way of getting cash flow out there. It does obviously present value to us, and the value is it allows us to plan our business, you know, with a more stable view of our supply. But we think that, you know, we've taken the approach that we think it's very fair from the point of view that we are offering this cash flow up front. We're looking for a commitment from our suppliers. If they need to change that commitment for some reason, that we don't think it's overly onerous in terms of them needing to exit those arrangements.
Surely, though, part of the reason at least is to try and secure some of your own base.
Oh, it is, absolutely. Oh, no, sorry, I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. No, exactly right. There is a value in having your supply able to be predicted over a 2 to 3 year period, obviously, and that's what this value reflects.
Is it partially too, I guess, more broadly speaking about the industry, do you think there should be fewer farmers jumping between suppliers? Is it a problem at an industry level?
Oh, look, I think what the industry needs overall, from the farmers to the processors and right on through, is a greater level of stability. Now, obviously, that stability has been that opportunity for stability is affected by a number of things, inclusive of the volatility of the world markets. But in the end, I think a stable industry has got better opportunity to be efficient, better opportunity to improve returns. But having said that, I think competition is a good thing, and competition is good for farmers.
Now, of course, there's been plenty of other dairy news, as there always seems to be, for quite some time now. Murray Goulburn and Saputo, that deal is looking closer, particularly given now the ACCC saying its concern was to do with Koroitin, Saputo saying, well, we're happy to exclude that from part of the deal. So given that there is a strong likelihood now that the Koroitin factory in the South Leithers estate will be up for offer, is Bega interested in buying it?
I think Bega's always interested in growing its dairy business, so I think the short answer to that would be yes, we would be interested. Obviously, it's still at early stages in terms of what that process might look like, but we would expect to be a participant.
Have you spoken to Saputo about registering that interest and what some of the finer details would be?
Look, the bottom line is, I think the undertaking between Saputo and the ACCC is still being finalised, and then of course Saputo have got to have the shareholder vote on the 5th of April. So the appropriate time to have those sorts of discussions is after all those things are out of the way.
That's Bega's Executive Chairman, Barry Irvin. Heaps of your rainfall texts coming through. It looks like most people, or at least that have been texting in, I suppose maybe if you haven't sent a text in, it's because you didn't get anything. But most people that have sent a text through seem to have got, well, you know, decent totals considering how little has been around. Matt at Yilma had 22. M at Lake Epilock had 18. Tony at Cobram, 8 mils there. First rain for a month. And I'm guessing Tony's not alone in that situation. Ian's been in touch too. 9.5 in the gauge at Wangaratta South. And Kay from Mineral Springs near Kyneton, 40 millimetres there. A great start, Kay says. 0467 842 722 is the text number here on the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria. If you'd like to get in touch with us and let us know, were you lucky enough to collect a little bit of rain over the course of the weekend? But it's just coming up to 12:15 here on the Country Hour. And just before we move to some other news, there is some other dairy news around today. Jerry Harvey of Harvey Norman fame has now put his dairy farming business into administration. Kumbuna Holdings, which is 49.9% owned by a Harvey Norman subsidiary, has now been placed into administration. That's in a letter that was registered with the Australian Stock Exchange. Now, that Goulburn Valley farm was purchased by Gerry Harvey back in 2015, and McGrath Nichols have been appointed as the receivers and managers. We have reached out for comment on that story. No one's been available, as it's really just been happening this morning, but we'll try and get some more details for you on that as soon as we can. Let's turn to another industry now. Victorian orchardists and horticulturalists are rallying against proposed labour hire laws before Parliament. The state Labour government, as I've mentioned, is proposing to increase the regulation of the labour hire industry. It's looking at things like increasing licensing for labour hire companies, but also auditing their standards. But the people who need pickers and workers aren't too happy about it. Warwick Long reports.
Cost them more and it'll do all those things. So
suits and business attire aren't commonplace in an orchard, but it is today in the Pink Lady apple block of an Unmona farm in northern Victoria. Shadow ministers, local politicians and farmers are meeting here to discuss proposed regulations by the Victorian government to licence labour hire contractors. But orchardists like Mitchell McNab, who employ seasonal workforces to pick his apples like those in this orchard, are worried.
No, it's very worrying because, the industry has been under pressure the last couple of years already, so, having these this bill introduced is only going to put further pressure on a lot of people and, it is making it harder and harder for us to do our job and produce, good quality fruit for us to supply to retailers and to the general public. So it's just going to make it a lot harder for us to do our job.
The government's $8.5 million plan wants labour hire firms to be licensed and compel businesses who use labour hire firms to only use licensed operators. There would be an authority to monitor and investigate the industry and criminal and civil penalties for those who don't comply. Victorian Farmers Federation Horticulture President Emma Germano says her industry is against the plan.
I guess this bill has been basically pitched at the fact that it's trying to protect vulnerable workers protect people from exploitation. There are laws in place that already protect those vulnerable workers, and we're saying that we want to see enforcement of those laws, and we want to see a country-wide, a national approach to this situation. We don't want to see one state government coming in thinking that they've got the silver bullet answer to a problem that's actually quite complex.
Want to see more enforcement?
Absolutely. We need, firstly, more staff, and then we want to see enforcement. So we want to be given the tools to succeed, and then we want to ensure that people are using those correct tools, and if they're not, then let's call that out. Let's get people the fines that they should be getting fined with, or whatever the appropriate punishment is for breaking the laws that already exist. We want to see that enforced.
Yeah, but obviously in a few high profile cases so far in the last year or two, that hasn't been happening, has it?
No, it absolutely hasn't. And I think that it's more of a PR activity about enforcement. So the government gets to come out and say, look what we're doing. See, we do care about this and we don't accept it. Let's put it on the front of the newspaper, and that means that we're doing our job. That's one. There's thousands and thousands of businesses and thousands of labour hire contractors. Who's checking all of that? Growers has, as a minimum, like a fresh care certification or some process where we could be getting audited for that, and we could be having to prove the ethical supply of our labour. That's not happening, but instead we're just probably going to see another few people on the front of a newspaper and an industry going unchecked.
What's the resolution here? What's the best outcome from the VFF's point of view? What would you like to see?
We need this bill defeated, and we want all the stakeholders to sit down and look at a holistic approach to fixing this issue of labour, whether it's the lack of availability of labour, whether it's the exploitation side of things. We want to see the federal inquiry that happened. We want to see those report recommendations put into place, and we want to be working together with people that represent the employers and government to put together some solution that's actually workable, not something that's going to fall over in another few years' time when we look back and realise that this was one big distraction.
Mitch McNab says the cost of extra compliance to the rules will hurt farmers because they'll have to pay more to comply and can't pass these costs onto supermarkets.
Yeah, ultimately they're going to pass that on, and unfortunately we can't go to retailers and say, you know, we've got a cost that we've had to bear, and so they're not going to take it on for us as well. So we are responsible for that, which is going to increase our cost production, and we already have a pretty shrinking margin already. So further costs are just going to make it, you know, less and less viable for our industry to continue.
The Liberal and National parties have said they'll vote against this bill, but it may still pass for the Labor government with crossbench support. Emma Germano from the VFF says she'll be working this week to stop that from happening.
We weren't actually consulted in regards to how this bill was written. It does seem when Victoria, at this time of the year, we're all busily picking our fruit and vegetables. We want to be on our farms, but instead we've got a lobby government that it looks like that it was tried to be slipped through as quickly as possible with as little consultation as possible.
That's the Victorian Farmers Federation Horticulture Group President Emma Germano, ending that report from Warwick Long. Heaps more of your rainfall texts coming through, some pretty decent ones in some instances as well. Graham from Gundaring, 57 millimetres, which was greatly appreciated. That's good to hear. Pat from Ararat, very nice rhyming name, 20 mils over the weekend for Pat. Robert Burrumbeet had 37. Ian at Eaglehawk, quite a bit less there, only 6.5. Neville from Fish Creek, some relatively good news for Neville, 45 millimetres over the weekend, the heaviest single rain for a year, believe it or not. 0467 842 722. If you'd like to get in touch with us, send us a text this lunchtime. Still to come, for Pete's sake, the challenge of putting out a peat fire. Apparently this fire that's going in the southwest of the state will take weeks, if not months, to be put out. One of the challenges is because it's been so dry lately.
Why is the peat burning? The peat's burning because it's dry. Why is it dry? Because there hasn't been a lot of rain. Water is valuable.
Indeed it is, as we've just been hearing on the text line. More on that soon.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Or it's 21 minutes past 12. Nikolai Bailhart's with you this afternoon. Well, the stretch of Murray River from Corowa to the Ovens River Junction is still under the microscope as water users try and share the load of mitigating erosion. More than 300 community submissions are now being reviewed after the draft river erosion management plan was released in December. Now, that proposed a restriction on some wake sports in the water. Murray-Darling Basin Authority Head of River Management, Andrew Reynolds, says landowners are also suffering from boat wash.
There are things like private land where there might be infrastructure on the riverbanks, pumps and the likes like that, that over time, if erosion occurs in those areas, then there's damage to that infrastructure, and landowners and other agencies need to invest to protect that. So there's a range of reasons that we seek to control the rate of erosion. Erosion in the Murray River is a natural process. The banks erode through natural flows, regulated rivers and the like. But over more recent times, we've seen an increase in the rate of erosion, particularly in the reach between Corowa and where the Ovens joins the Murray at Bundalong. We've had a long-standing program to implement works to reduce the level of erosion through re-establishing vegetation, excluding stock, and constructing physical works with log revetment and rock beaching. And those works have been pretty successful over a long period of time at reducing erosion under floods and natural sort of river conditions. What we've seen in more recent years, though, is that a lot of those works are not standing up to the more forceful impact of boat wash, and that's been increasing a lot with the increased prevalence of large wake-producing boats that are popular for sports like wakeboarding and wake surfing. So we've instituted this trial, or are looking to institute a trial, where we exclude that sort of activity from a part of the river that's particularly susceptible, to see whether we can reduce that rate of erosion.
That's where New South Wales Roads and Maritime Principal Manager Southern Maritime, Michael Hammond, comes in. He says some river users are changing their habits on the water due to increased wake activity.
The boats have become not only more numerous but a lot larger over the last few years, so the impact that they have on other river users is pretty significant. So when the MDBA approached us, we agreed to take a look at it and work with them. So there really are two reasons to do something and two agencies with different responsibilities working together to try and, I guess, ensure the long-term health of the river. But also for us, because New South Wales Maritime supports boating and boating access, we want to ensure the long-term viability of all forms of boating, including wakeboarding. So we're not trying to say this is something that should stop and not happen everywhere. we're trying to say that it needs to be appropriately managed and the impacts on other river users appropriately managed so that it can have a future. And I suppose our view is that if we don't do something now and we leave it for another period, then more drastic action might be needed in the future, which we'd like to avoid. There's a wide range of waterway users that use the Murray River. I guess everything from canoes and kayaks through to small fishing boats and runabouts. Then you've got a water ski community, and there's a lot of water skiing in that area, which, by the way, will still be allowed everywhere where it's allowed now under what we're proposing. And then there's wakeboarding, which has grown a lot over the last decade or a bit more, and a newer sport, which is wake surfing, where, you know, not always, but typically the waves are even larger, and it's essentially wakeboarding with no rope attached to the vessel. So the wave itself is big enough to propel the rider along without the need for a rope. There are personal watercraft, and they're commonly known as jet skis. What we're hearing some people tell us is that they no longer do some of those activities because of the impact of large waves, and that includes water skiers as well, who tell us that, you know, they used to water ski, but they bought a wake boat because of the larger freeboard, and their smaller ski boats have been swamped, or they didn't feel like they could enjoy it in the way they used to.
You called for community feedback and you got 305 submissions.
We did.
Was there a general tone to those submissions, or did they all throw up 305 different ideas?
Well, there were many different ideas, which was great. We genuinely wanted to, you know, receive honest feedback, and we got a lot of ideas, including some alternative proposals, and those are things that we're definitely open to considering. Quite a number of the submissions were in favour of taking some action, and obviously there are quite a few from those who are concerned about this, who saw it as perhaps the start of a broader campaign against wake sports, which is really not the case.
What were the main concerns of landowners?
Landowners are concerned about erosion, because some landowners feel that they have lost some of their riverbanks, and that the work that they do to try and protect riverbanks is undermined by large wake. Some of their foreshore riverfront land has eroded, and they've lost, you know, meterage of land.
What stage are we at with the report?
Yeah, well, I guess what we're doing now is considering the submissions. We've received a lot of them. It's possible that there'll be changes. It's possible there'll be no changes.
And if there are changes, Andrew Reynolds wants river users to remember the important environmental reasons for them.
Erosion's an issue, a problem, and something we try to manage for a number of reasons. One of the primary ones is that the riverbank vegetation's really important for the health of the river, both in stabilising the riverbanks but also providing habitat for fish and other bugs and grubs that live in the river. And when we get significant erosion, it breaks down that vegetation, and of course then you have bare banks, and so you don't have that important habitat.
That's the Murray-Darling Basin Authority's Andrew Reynolds sending that report from Megan Ruth.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
The Australian Melon Association says it's now ramping up its food safety guidelines to try and win back consumer confidence following that outbreak of listeria in rock melons. Six people have died since the outbreak was identified in February, and despite authorities' assurances that rock melons are now safe to eat, those that are on sale, farmers say they've lost millions in the subsequent fallout. The association says it's now working directly with growers to ensure stringent sanitation, hygiene and record-keeping standards are in place. Industry Development Manager Diane Fullilove told Kelly Buchanan it's critical that confidence is restored.
These are guidelines that we've had in the industry for many years. Their HACCP, Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point processes that ensure that food is safe to eat so that consumers can feel confident in the product we're putting on shelves.
So what's different about what you're implementing now to what was previously in place?
What we're doing is bringing out a project which is grower-funded to provide individual support for growers as sort of like a critical friend, I guess we could term it, where they support the growers to make sure that their systems are absolutely as good as they can be.
So have you been able to see the New South Wales Food Authority's report on what's caused the contamination at this stage?
No, not at the moment. They are still doing testing and awaiting results. They have told us that those results will be in next week of further testing, and we're hopeful after that to receive some information about what might have been the cause of the contamination, because growers are very concerned that they want to know where it went wrong so that they can make any changes in their system if necessary.
And how do you know then, if we don't yet know the cause, how do you know that these guidelines will be enough to restore that confidence that you're looking for from consumers?
We have very good food safety guidelines already in Australia. We need them to be implemented at the very best level that we can possibly do. And in this industry, the melon growers want to make sure that they're going above and beyond what's expected of them to get the very best result for food to be safe.
So just to be clear, to make sure that I'm understanding this clear, these are guidelines that have already been in place. What you're doing is reinforcing them by offering support to growers to ensure that they're implemented properly in their operations.
That's exactly right. Every farm is different, every packing shed is different. So there's never going to be one size fits all. So we feel at this stage that the growers will benefit from having that one-on-one assistance to help them ensure that their systems are good. These are the sorts of systems that growers are very familiar with, such as FreshCare, SQF and Global Gap. They're HACCP-based systems that growers have already. We just want to go through those systems, make sure that they're working as well as they can be, and then when we do find out what may have gone wrong on this farm that had the issue, we can then ensure that that will not occur on any other farms.
How significant has the cost of this outbreak been to the melon industry?
It's been significant. We estimate already that growers in the southern areas have lost about $15 million. If we don't restart the market before the northern season comes online, we were looking at losses of up to $60 million. So we are really pushing that consumers now can buy rock melons that are on the shelves, they are safe to eat. All of the product that was contaminated has been removed for a number of weeks.
That's Australian Melon Industry Development Manager Diane Fullilove speaking there with Kelly Buchanan. It's 29 to 1 here on the Country Hour. That does mean it's time to get the latest in local news headlines now with Bridget Rollinson. Afternoon, Bridget.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. A salvage operation is underway for a yacht that ran aground at Cape Conran in Victoria's east overnight. The 43-foot yacht was being delivered to Tasmania from New South Wales when it ran out of fuel 200 metres west of Salmon Rocks about midnight. The sailor, a 54-year-old Tasmanian man, told police the anchor wouldn't hold in extreme winds and the yacht started drifting to shore. Police are investigating after a teenage boy was accidentally shot in the stomach on Saturday morning near Deniliquin on the New South Wales border. Emergency services were called to the rural property just before 11 o'clock following reports a 12-year-old had suffered a gunshot wound to the abdomen. The boy was treated at the scene before being flown to the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne in a serious condition. An aged care facility in southwest Victoria has relocated its residents as air quality concerns mount over two peat fires that continue to burn east of Warrnambool. More than 70 people have been forced to leave their homes since late last week due to large amounts of smoke coming from peat fires around Cobrico. And a woman has been arrested after a police raid on a number of Ararat properties allegedly uncovered illicit drugs. The 34-year-old Ararat woman has been charged with trafficking methamphetamines and possessing the proceeds of crime. And for more news, head to our website, abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Bridget Rollison, there with local news headlines. Bridget mentioned there that peat fire, it seems like that will be going for some time in the state's southwest. So we'll find out a little bit more about why it's so hard to put those fires out. Rain is one thing that does help, and there's been a little bit of it over the weekend. Obviously not enough to put that fire out, but a few more of your rainfall texts coming through on the text line. 18 mils at Bandiana. Crawford to Tura had 8 since Saturday night. Stu the Farmer, 18 mils over the weekend in Thorpedale, raining on and off today. And Mel in Beechworth had 31. So keep those rainfall texts coming in. Particularly keen to know if it's provided enough relief for you or if you really do still need a little bit more. 0467 842 722 is the text number if you'd like to get in touch. Let's find out a little bit more about how much rain fell and where. Rod Dixon's on duty at the Bureau. Hi, Rod.
Hi, Nicolay.
It does seem like most people, not everywhere, but most people got a decent fall over the course of the weekend.
Yeah, that's right. Broadly speaking, most areas picked up around the 10 to 15 millimetre mark, but some significantly higher falls than that about the central and eastern ranges. The areas that missed out, though, were really the northwest of the state, where 1 or 2 millimetres was really the best that they could muster, perhaps just up to 5 millimetres in some areas. Swan Hill had around 6, so it was that northwest that that really didn't receive a great deal this weekend. But over the weekend, there was as much as 84 millimetres recorded at Mount Hotham, and so that upper northeast recorded between around 60 and 80 millimetres, and some parts of the central ranges recording between 30 and 50 millimetres for the weekend. And the cold front last night has brought much cooler conditions. Temperatures across the Alps falling to around -3 or -4 degrees this morning. So we've seen a little bit of snowfall about the Alpine areas earlier this morning. But at the moment, most of the shower activity lies across southern Victoria, and in particular, the west and south Gippsland coast is still seeing a few heavy showers down that way. Since 9 a.m, some rainfall totals between around 5 and 8 millimetres recorded down there. Just lighter showers getting onto the coast further west across the southwest and central districts. And we'll see that shower activity contract to the coast later this afternoon and into the evening, and should clear up by tonight. But temperatures across the state today reasonably cool, with the southwesterly winds still quite fresh and gusty across the coast. We've got still a severe weather warning for damaging winds about parts of the Gippsland coast for the remainder of the afternoon. Most maximum temperatures today ranging between around 18 and 20 degrees. Then it looks like, as I mentioned, those showers will clear up tonight, and we'll be back to fine conditions. But it'll be another chilly start to the day tomorrow, with minimum temperatures dropping to around about 5 to 6 degrees over inland Victoria tomorrow, around 9 or 10 degrees along the coast. And then maximum temperatures tomorrow up into the low 20s for most areas, just reaching into the mid-20s across the far north. I think it'll be a sunny start to the day on Tuesday, but the cloud will increase from the west during the afternoon. That's ahead of another weak front, which will move in on Wednesday. As that cloud thickens up towards Tuesday evening, there's just a slight chance of a shower or two falling out of that, mainly over the southwest and central district on Tuesday night, but really little significant rainfall coming out of that. That shower activity will contract eastwards on Wednesday morning, fairly early in the morning, so the bulk of Wednesday will be fine as well. That weak front will move into the west of the state during the afternoon, but it's weakening as it moves across. We'll see northerly winds freshen up throughout the late morning and early afternoon on Wednesday. That should push temperatures up into the high 20s across most of the state, and up into the low 30s across the northwest, expecting around 32 or 33 degrees over the Mallee. And not much to follow that front on the Wednesday, just some light shower or drizzle activity across southern Victoria on Thursday morning. That should clear up fairly quickly, and generally a mostly sunny day to follow. Mild conditions, although still warm in the north and east, where temperatures reach the high 20s to low 30s, generally around the mid-20s elsewhere. And then by Friday and the long weekend, it looks like we'll get another very weak front pass through to the south for Friday. So that might just give us a shower or two across southern Victoria. Looks like fine on Saturday, and possibly another front on Sunday, but very isolated shower activity expected with that. So no further significant rainfall, unfortunately, in the coming outlook.
Okay, thanks so much, Rod.
No worries.
Well, Dixon on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. And can you believe it? There was snow near Mount Buller and Hotham this morning too. If you head to the Golden Murray Facebook page, ABC Golden Murray Facebook page, you can see a fair bit of it fell this morning as well. So we're getting a little bit of everything at the moment. More of your rainfall texts. 43 mils at Thougla Valley. Jill had 30 mils at Tynong North and says it was much needed, so that's good to hear. And similarly, 23 mils at Dixie, very grateful for that, so that's good to hear too. Cam had 18 mils at Redcastle as well. 0467 842 722 is the text number if you would like to get in touch.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it is 21 to 1. Nikolai Beilharts with you. Well, a pet food processor has slammed the state government for not committing to extending a kangaroo pet food trial. Now, that trial will finish at the end of this week. The opposition has committed to make the trial permanent and also wants to include the use of hunted deer. Jess Davis spoke with Victorian Pet Food Processors plant manager David Priest, who says 100 jobs will be lost at the end of this week.
Currently, the state government has given us no indication of whether the trial will continue. We are left in the absolute wild, basically. We predict that there's 100 job losses that will go because of this trial hasn't been extended, both at our company and two other operators that are operating within this kangaroo pet food trial. I suspect we'll all be putting employees off, because we can no longer keep them employed.
And you'll have to do that, you know, without any notice, I suppose, because trial will be finished at the end of this week.
That's right. That was predetermined, the trial would finish there, and at this point in time, the state government has refused to give us any indication whether or not it will be extended.
So for a bit of background, how long has the trial been going for, and has it been a success from your point of view?
Yes, it has. They had a trial 3 years ago, possibly, but version one of the trial, then they extended that to version two, and now that version two is about to stop. And in this period of time, there's been a number of kangaroos that have been processed by two or three operators, and they're still there. These kangaroos are still out there causing trouble on the roads and on the farms. And the trial, the industry, the pet food industry, wants these Victorian kangaroos to be able to be used as pet food instead of just shooting them and leaving the resources on the ground, which is what used to happen prior to the trial.
There was a bit of controversy a couple of weeks ago with the documentary about kangaroo culling. Did you have any consumer backlash or anything from the release of that movie?
No, we didn't. I knew that movie was coming and I haven't seen it, and I've actually heard no response at all about it.
The Nationals have also announced that they would extend the trial and that they would include deer into that trial as well. What's your reaction to deer being included?
Yeah, look, deer, we can have process deer. The industry can process deer. We just need to know the guidelines and how that needs to be done. Again, we have had no input from the current state government. They're not talking to us, that they're beating around the bush that they might do this, but they're not actually talking to their operators.
So why do you think they're not talking to you?
I think because we've got a state election coming up in November and they're too scared of the Greens. That's my personal opinion.
So do you think that they will extend the trial or they'll just sort of leave dead air here?
No, I think they'll sit on it. They'll sit on it until after the election.
So for a business who's done the trial and then you'll have a break between the trial ending and a new policy starting, how do you start that business back up again?
Well, it's very difficult to manage to get the sales back up, the kangaroo pet meat sales, because that will just be picked up from interstate operators, New South Wales, South Australia. They'll just pick that up, and again, the Victorian operators have got to start all over again. The shooters are out there. We've got trained professional shooters that are there. They will not be able to do it until such time as the government comes back on board, issues us the right to go and do it. The shooters will come back quickly, we suspect, unless they've gone off and found different jobs and don't want to do it anymore. But the problem at the minute is that it just cold stops. It's like having a wool industry that no longer, you just can't sell your wool or you can't sell your sheep. But what do we do with them all? I'd just like the state government to make a decision and then try and work out what they're going to do with 100-odd people that are unemployed. Just kick them back out onto the dole. You know, they're just not thinking. And there's an industry there that's viable, that's working, yet they're just going to close the doors on it on the 30th of March.
That's Victorian Pet Food Processors plant manager David Priest speaking there to Jess Davis. And we have contacted the Victorian government for comment. More of your rainfall text coming through. An absolutely heartbreaking one from Stephen. Droughtbreaker, very much tongue in cheek, I think. 1.4 millimetres northwest of Kanaiva. And as we've just heard, one of the few areas the northwest of the state to largely miss out on these rainfalls. It's been a very long time without rain there, so I'm very sorry to hear that. BJ had 10.5 at Narradra near Natamuck, near Horsham. Peter had 36 at Wenderee. And a question from Linda at Albury, wanting to know more information about how those rock melons were contaminated by the Listeria bacteria. The latest that we have on that is that the New South Wales Food Authority has conducted tests to try and identify the exact cause of that outbreak. The results of those tests are expected next week. So next week we should have a clear idea of what exactly caused that Listeria outbreak amongst those rock melons. It's 16-1.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Now, while the bushfires in southwest Victoria are now controlled, they are continuing to burn deep down in the earth. Peat is causing the fires to continue to burn beneath the surface, and it's causing a major problem for residents and people, including farmers, who live at and near Cabrico. Dr. Bridget Thornton, the CEO of the Bushfire and Natural Hazards CRC, says it's likely the fire, with its smoke, will burn for some time.
They're somewhat rare, particularly in the Australian context. We've seen them before in Western Australia and a few other states around the country, but they're relatively rare because the drivers for peat fires requires sort of drought or a lower rainfall than we've seen historically. So they are relatively rare, and of course they only occur in areas with major peat deposits.
And if people aren't familiar, I mean, technically, what is peat?
Peat is sort of compressed vegetation that usually occurs around wetlands. We see it a lot, and I guess some of the most famous examples of peat is that it's used for fuel in Ireland, and there's the big peat cutters that take a lot of these peat bogs and dry them out and use them actually as fuel in fires.
Okay, and so one of the things that's been mentioned quite a bit in the coverage of this fire is that they tend to burn for an incredibly long time, weeks if not months, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, and we've seen many examples of fires going on for many months, and particularly in places like Indonesia and in areas in Africa where they've burnt for months on end. And part of that is that they burn relatively deep in the soil, so they're not above ground fires, they're below ground fires, which makes them incredibly difficult to put out. And the only real way that they can be extinguished is through major rainfall events or the water table coming back to what it was previously.
Okay, because I guess that's the obvious response, isn't it? Is, well, why don't we just put a bunch of water on it and put it out? But that wouldn't work.
And it's also hard to locate exactly where the fire is because it's beneath ground. Yes, you can use some heat sensing equipment above ground, but some of these could be a couple of metres below the ground because the peat is fairly deep. So there's a lot of work and a lot of research that's been conducted around the world about how do we actually get to some of the material that's actually burning, because you don't want to create extra environmental damage by digging out the fires either. And that can create a whole load of new problems.
Okay, and what's the risk there?
The risk that we see, particularly about people working around these fires, is you might have a fire that's burning, say, less than a metre underground, but you can't see it on the surface. Somebody can walk across it and the land can subside, I guess, because it's burnt out the material underside. And you end up with putting your foot into what's effectively a burning fire. So that's not good for firefighters. It's not good for the farmers in the area. So it's actually a risk that we have to be careful of when you work around peat fires.
And I gather smoke, too, is one of the other issues.
Yeah, smoke is the big issue. They tend to be, because they're largely smouldering fires, they're not open fires. We know that smouldering fires generate a lot more carbon monoxide than you see in flaming fires. They also produce a lot more particulate matter, so the particles that are coming out of these fires, which are one of the major causes of some of the respiratory illnesses that we're seeing.
And so just to wrap things up, you've touched on this earlier, but I guess for this instance, this fire in the state southwest, what's the likely way that it will eventually be extinguished?
Look, I think the firefighters will do what they can. I think the main way in which they'll be extinguished is through the winter period when we get the decent rainfall coming through. I think that the challenge we have up until that point is that these fires on hot days can re-emerge into the surface and start fires maybe some way from where they originally originated. So these will be an ongoing watching activity for the fire services for some time until we get a major rain event.
That's Dr. Richard Thornton. He's CEO of the Bushfire and Natural Hazards CRC.
The AFL, an iconic Australian sport.
Bursting away and kicking the opener.
The ABC, the Australian broadcaster with a rich history of AFL coverage.
Sidesteps, he can seal it, he does,
ABC Grandstand and the AFL continue to deliver live and commercial-free coverage of our great game.
Every week, every round, with ABC Grandstand.
On ABC Radio Victoria.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
I wonder if you ever got this when you were a kid. If you eat your crusts, your hair will go curly. Well, it's a pretty common tactic for parents encouraging their children to eat the whole sandwich. New Zealand scientists, though, with the help of a Japanese cosmetic company, have worked out what makes hair curl. It's not bread. Key to the discovery was the merino sheep. Isabella Pittaway reports.
I have curly hair. It's big and never looks the same after I wash it. I'm constantly getting my headphones caught in my hair, and if I had a dollar for every time someone with straight hair told me they wished theirs was curly, well, I'd be much better set for retirement. But what actually causes curly hair to curl? Despite decades of research, scientists were clueless until they turned their attention to the famous wool-producing breed of sheep, the Merino. Dr. Dwayne Harland from Ag Research in New Zealand says the structure and growth of all hair is essentially the same, so lessons learned from sheep's wool will also apply to human hair.
In this case, we chose merino wool in particular because of its very fine wool. The technique we were using, we need to be able to see right away through the fibre. And fibres that were much thicker than that, we wouldn't have been able to investigate. And also, it isn't pigmented, so again, because we were using light, if we were using coloured fibres like majority of human hair is, we just simply wouldn't be able to see inside.
The process to see inside the merino wool fibres was fiddly and painstakingly long, with 700 individual fibres used.
We washed those again, and then we let them relax in the water to take on their natural shape. And then, of course, you know, just put them on a surface and dry them. They might get curled, they might dry to the surface and get a bit of extra curl or less curl. So we actually had to dry them while bouncing them. You know, single wool fibre is so small you can't easily see it with just your eyes. So having to actually bounce these things around, we lost an awful lot of them. You can imagine they just, 1 minute you're looking at a wool fibre, the next minute it's entered the atmosphere somewhere and flown off. So we had to dry these things on a vibrating surface on some cardboard. We did, of course, hundreds of these, and then we took those fibres that we were happy with, and we cut those up into tiny little snippets, and then we selected only those snippets that looked like they were a nice uniform piece of curvature that was easy to understand, lying flat on a glass slide.
From there, they found the answer to the curly question. Researchers found whether or not you get curls depends on how cells are stacked on the hair follicle.
We went into this looking for two options. One, that there was just more cells on one side of the fibre, the outside of the fibre than the inside, or the other one being that the cells on the outside were longer and of a different type than the ones on the inside. And that's what we found. So it confirmed one of the theories that curvature is caused by different cell types of different length on either side of the fibre, and that one of them has extended during the fibre growth to push that growing hair over onto its side to form the curvature. That idea that it's either longer on one side or not, it was there, but we're the first people to actually have been able to test this directly.
In some good news for people looking to tame their curly tresses, Dr. Harland says the discovery could help cosmetic companies like Cow Corporation, which funded the research, to develop new products.
So when the cells change from wet to dry or dry to wet, they will lengthen or shorten. We know that that's what needs controlling in order to prevent that happening or perhaps to actually curl your hair without actually doing any physical damage or chemical damage to it, which is the way in which most hair processes work at the moment. So you could imagine that if a cow corporation was able to develop a product that affected this, they might be able to help people whose hair, you know, to reduce the effects of hair getting wet.
That's Dr. Duane Harlan speaking there with our Gippsland reporter Isabella Pittaway. A few more of your rainfall texts to round us out. 32 millimetres at Tarradale, that's from JC, and quite like this one, showing how dry it's been. Until Saturday, I forgot that I had holes in my boots. Finally got wet feet.
From ABC Books, the home of great Australian stories, take a look back at a time few can remember through the extraordinary first-hand accounts in Great Australian World War II Stories. These riveting true stories shared by diggers and nurses, POWs and entertainers, sailors and airmen have been collected in one volume. Great Australian World War II Stories. Available now from bookshops, ABC centres and abcshop.com.au.
That means it's time to head off to the livestock markets. Let's start today at Pakenham with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Nicolai. Numbers are decreased to 1320. That's 320 fewer, with the usual buying group operating in a dearer market in places. Quality was limited, with many cattle still lacking finish. Well-finished veal is lifted up to 10 cents. Yearling trade steers sold firm. Heifers sold from firm to 9 cents dearer. Grown steers and bullocks held firm. Heavy manufacturing steers gained 5 to 10. Cows were mostly 3 to 6 cents dearer and more in places, with processors loading heavyweights for an estimated 388 to 430 cents a kilogram carcass weight. The heavy bulls improved slightly. Feelers to butchers sold from 285 to 337. Yearling trade steers 260 to 303. The heifers to the trade 240 to 306. Grown steers 242 to 265 to processors. Bullocks 250 to 270. Heavy Frisian steers 202 to 212. Crossbreds 214 to 258. Most light and medium weight cows 150 to 204, heavyweights 188 to 229, and heavy bulls 209 to 265. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Now to Bendigo and Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers are similar to 19,000. The sheep draw was decreased by 3,000 to around 5,000 head at Bendigo. Collie with the yarding range from some good to very good pens of heavy lambs, many medium weight lambs with a limited selection of lighter weight lambs at the ends of aged runs. Regular prices are tender, with most of them operating in a slightly easier market overall. Price was $3 to $6 cheaper for the heavy lambs, and medium tray weights were confirmed to $2 lower, as light lambs sold $4 easier. The restock has paid mostly between $20 to $115 during the market. The lightweight two-school lambs made between $76 to $93. A light tray weight two- and three-school sold from $95 to $122. That's averaged 624 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Medium weight lambs two- and three-school sold from $115 to $132. Medium weight grass with more cover sold between $134 to $146 as they average 615 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy tray weight lambs, three and four school sold $145 to $158. Heavy lambs suiting exporters sold between $170 to the market top of $213 as they average 580 cents a kilogram carcass weight with the sheep yet to be sold. Tim Delaney reporting for MLA Bendigo.
Thanks so much, Tim. And now to Wagga and Leanne Dax.
Numbers were back by 500, with agents yarding 4,185. Quality is very mixed, with the yarding lacking the quality lines of breeder cattle we generally see. Trade and heavy cattle are once again limited. Field, too few to quote, 270 to 320. Trade steers are back 7, 274 to 295. Feeder steers are holding firm to 4 cents easier, 272 to 308. Feeder heifers are firm, 236 to 284. Trade heifers have jumped 8 cents, 248 to 277. Heavy grown steers, 500 to 600 kilo, 265 to 282. They're up 4 cents. Heavy heifers with shape have lifted 7, 240 to 278. Cows are holding firm. For the heavy portion, 194 to 216. And leaner grades, 162 to 192. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks very much, Leanne. Now let's find out what's coming up on Statewide Drive with Nicole Trevastic. Afternoon, Nicole.
Afternoon. How are you doing?
Very well.
We're going to go to the southwest of the state. I know you were talking about those peat fires. Extraordinary. We got word of this on Friday, that the carbon monoxide was actually forcing evacuations, and they happened on, I think they started to happen on in the early hours of Friday morning, and then there was a second wave on Friday and more over the weekend.
Mm.
So, as you say, it's an extraordinary, this phenomenon of peat burning several metres under the earth. And people are in strife. There are some people in, you know, real strife down that way who have had to deal with bushfires and now have to deal with a carbon monoxide threat.
Yep, that's exactly it. Just when you think maybe it's over, this keeps going.
Yeah. And, I mean, we've heard of a bloke who lost his house and now his boots, all of his boots have melted because he's on the fire ground trying to assist and trying to clean up and trying to make some sense of this. And he keeps on going through these boots because the ground is so hot.
Wow.
You know, cattle being shot, it's full on there. Mm. And so we're going to return to that story today. And, of course, we're also going to have a look at cricket. Did the punishment fit the crime? Steve Smith and David Warner sensationally stand down from the Australian captaincy and vice-captaincy for the rest of the third test. Should they be gone for all time?
Mm.
We will have that discussion on Statewide Drive this afternoon.
That is coming up this afternoon from 3 o'clock here on ABC Radio Victoria with Nicole Javastic for Statewide Drive. That's it for the Country Hour for today. ABC.net.au/rural if you want to know anything more about what you've heard this lunchtime. It's 1 o'clock.